Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with journalist Janet Reitman, who takes us inside the closed world of Scientology.
They have an innate mistrust of journalists, particularly, who they believe are really out to get them. They call journalists merchants of chaos.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Adam Ross discusses his new short story collection.
I am very interested in, ladies and gentlemen, with the responsibility of the listener to the storyteller. Like, what does it mean when you say to someone, tell me your story?
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Scientology, it keeps getting weirder and weirder, and we keep hearing more about it, but we don't know very much about it. Now there's an exceptional book. It's called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. It's by Janet Reitman, and it's reviewed this week by none other than the great Gary Wills, who says that Reitman has given us the most complete picture yet of Scientology. I'm delighted that Janet's here to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this cult religion, what is it exactly? Tell us briefly, if it's possible, what Scientology is.
It's a spiritual movement of sorts, and I look at it as what I would call a commercially driven spiritual enterprise. So that means it has a commercial component, it has a spiritual religious component, in quotations, and is global, and it is a movement of sorts. It is hard to put it into one specific category because it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and it really depends on who you are, how you would interpret Scientology. At least here in the United States government, it is an official religion. It is protected by the Constitution. It has been given 501c3 nonprofit status. And there are lots of people who have grown up in Scientology for whom this is the only religion they have ever known. And so for them, it is a religion.
Now, Janet, one of the points that our reviewer Gary Wills makes is just how much of this is about money.
If we want to say that Scientology is a religion, and let's say that for the purposes of discussion, it is the only religion that I, or probably most of your listeners, have ever heard of that charges for every single thing that you need to do. Any counseling, any course, any advising, any kind of progression up the spiritual ladder. Because Scientology is one of these religions where you progress upwards to greater and greater and greater enlightenment. Every step along the way costs money, and it can cost more and more and more money. And so it's a fee-based religion, if nothing else. And that makes it both completely unusual in Western religion and also very inaccessible to lots of different people.
Janet, there are some very famous, extremely wealthy people involved in Scientology. Tom Cruise is an example everyone knows. What kind of money have they paid to this church? Are we talking about millions of dollars?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. I mean, Tom Cruise has contributed millions of dollars, absolutely, no doubt. So has John Travolta. Nancy Cartwright, who is the voice of Bart Simpson, gave $10 million, I believe, not very long ago. These are just donations to the church's various funds, say an anti-psychiatry agenda, which they have, or to fund their educational programs, or to fund some initiative, or to just give to the church as a form of donating to the church. That, I believe, would be exclusive of what they're paying to actually do the coursework and do the auditing or the counseling that helps them advance in Scientology.
Auditing, what is that? And what are these people getting in return for these enormous outlays of cash? What do they think they're getting?
They think they're getting greater and greater spiritual freedom, and ultimately total spiritual freedom, which is enlightenment, complete enlightenment, a kind of nirvana. They begin this process through a form of counseling. In many ways, it resembles a very structured kind of talk therapy, which is called auditing. The auditing is focused on specific problems a person might be having, a trauma that they want to clear away from their past. And the idea is that the more of these problems, which are called engrams, these are psychic scars, so to speak, that we all carry around with us. And they're the root of a lot of our problems in our current life. And they go way, way back, you know, back to birth, back to the womb, back to even before that. the idea is to get rid of these traumas, these engrams. And you do that through auditing, which is considered very technological. It's a science, according to Scientology. There are very specific questions you ask. There are very very specific ways that you go about it. And if you follow this kind of guideline, almost like a map, then you will ultimately help the person clear their problems away, and that will be the end of it. And then they'll move on to the next. You follow a script almost.
And briefly, L. Ron Hubbard created this. This was his brainchild. Who was he?
L. Ron Hubbard was a science fiction writer and a rather brilliant man, very eccentric, but clearly a brilliant man in his way, who in 1950 came up with something he called Dianetics. It was a very famous book. It became a bestseller. It was called The Modern Science of Mental Health. And Dianetics was based on this principle that we have these psychic scars called engrams that need to be cleared, which you can do through auditing, that your mind is divided into two categories. You have a reactive mind and you have an analytical mind. The analytical mind would be the mind that is very rational, that processes everything normally, that is healthy. And the reactive mind would be like your unconscious, you know, the mind that you can't control and that does things that are erratic and that lead to, you know, all kinds of problems. The idea is to sort of perfect, in a way, your analytical mind, get rid of the reactive mind. And if you can get rid of this reactive mind, you will reach a state called clear. At that place, you will be completely free of all of your hangups, all of your neuroses, even some of your psychosomatic illnesses. Hubbard considered asthma psychosomatic. He considered nearsightedness psychosomatic. He said that Dianetics could cure some of that stuff as well.
Do we have any idea how many Scientologists there are in the United States or around the world? How many people subscribe, belong to the religion?
It's really, really, really hard to know because Scientology claims to have somewhere between 8 and 11 or 12 million people, million members all over the world. That number, by the way, has shifted. It goes back and forth. I've seen 8, I've seen 10, I've seen 11. In reality, the best estimate I could give you would probably be, I'm going to say generously a million, maybe 500,000. Realistically, maybe 250,000 that are real practicing members worldwide, and maybe about 50,000 to 100,000 in our own country.
Jenna, Gary Will says you spent 5 years trying to pierce the wall of secrecy that's raised against outsiders. How do you report a book like this? How does a really skilled, practiced, professional journalist penetrate this particular universe?
You know, it's really based on trust. One of the things with Scientology that is makes it such a hard organization to research is that they have an innate mistrust of journalists, particularly, who they believe are really out to get them. They call journalists merchants of chaos, and we're considered, in their lexicon, suppressive people, suppressive, bad, just bad energy people, people that are going to only do them harm. So the first hurdle is to convince people who have left the church, because to talk to somebody who is still within the church is even more difficult, and I can explain that in a minute. But initially, when you talk to people who have left the church, who have never spoken to a reporter before, those were the people that I was going after, convincing them that you're okay. And it was a very, very slow process. It started with one person, and then that one person would have a good experience, and then they would call their friend, and then the friend would call their other friend, and it became, you know, something like that. And I would have multiple meetings with people, and I would fly back and forth from New York to Los Angeles all the time, meeting with various people, sometimes in secret locations.
Because it's centered in Los Angeles.
It's centered in Los Angeles and in Clearwater, Florida, which is near Tampa. You know, I met with a Scientologist who lived up in New Hampshire. You know, I talked to people. There were people in Dallas, Texas I spoke with. They're all over the country. But in terms of the big communities, they tend to be in Florida, in the Tampa Bay area, and also in the LA area.
What about documents? Archival material, government, Freedom of Information Act material? You mentioned in the book something like 200 suits that Scientologists have lodged against the IRS. Are there materials like that that you can get your hands on, or are they off limits to?
There's a lot of stuff that's out there now, actually. I mean, I have to give credit to the internet. Lots of people left Scientology in the past 10 years or so, and they brought with them a tremendous number of internal documents that they began to leak. And these documents were leaked online onto websites. They were leaked on WikiLeaks you know, long before they did anything else, they were taking on Scientology. Mm. Actually, I think that was one of their first campaigns. And they published, they had a whole secret stash of Scientology documents, a tremendous number of these documents, which I then would look at and then cross-reference with the sources I had that had those documents in hard copy. I traveled to people's homes to look at the documents they had. One of my sources in Los Angeles had an entire garage filled with documents. Another source in Florida had an airplane hangar full of documents. And so I went through that stuff there.
Is this a little bit like leaving the Communist Party? You're still scarred. You remain a kind of ex-Scientologist once you're out.
It is. There are different types. I mean, you can have an ex-Scientologist who is a critic, a very strong critic, very, very angry and embittered, and who some people have made it almost, you know, a kind of a career to criticize the church. And then other people are quieter. And I call them, in my book, I call them quiet defectors. And those were the people that I was particularly interested in finding because I felt that their accounts were more credible. What happened, interestingly, was that over the years that I was interviewing them, some of those quiet defectors became much louder because of the internet, because of the bad press that Scientology started to get, and especially around 2007, 2008, because of the Tom Cruise stuff. There was a video of Tom Cruise that was leaked, and it just caused a lot of stir. And so when they became more open, some of these people wrote their own memoirs. They began to blog. You know, I had no control over that. But originally, I went specifically for people who had never spoken to reporters before, who had no lawsuits against the church, and who were just trying to get on with their lives and recoup after spending, in some cases, 25, 30, 35 years in the Church of Scientology.
Now, what about people still in the church? Were you able to speak with those who were still practicing?
Yes, I did. Over the years, I interviewed a number of people who are still practicing, with the exception of one who is a character in my book and somebody who I have remained very close to ever since I met her. They were accompanied by Scientology officials, or they were given recording devices by the church to record the interview. Any reporter, whether you're covering, you know, the Church of Scientology or you're writing a story about the U.S. government or anything else, no reporter wants to be in that situation where you're having, you know, some, like, the flack listening in on the other end of your phone or whatever. And so you just don't feel that what you're getting is as honest. It became very difficult for me to include a lot of Scientologists in the book, you know, in the way that I had initially wanted, because I just felt that they weren't in full being 100% with me, except for this one girl. She was 17 when I met her, and her parents gave her complete permission. She's now 23, I think, and she's about to go to law school. And, you know, she's been fantastic ever since I met her. She's definitely somebody who I feel, you know, very, very strongly that I got a full and truthful and real story from her. But with the other Scientologists, it was always something that was filtered through the church. And I felt that the church, because the church is very controlling of its membership, they were sort of giving me what they were supposed to tell me.
And where's the church now? Is this a critical moment in the life or history of the Church of Scientology?
Yeah, I actually think this is probably the most critical moment. They are really, really at a crossroads, and they are facing a revolution, actually. In the past 2 years, they've lost a number of very high-level officials, high-ranking officials. A man named Marty Rathbun, and another man named Mike Rinder, who was an official in the church when I was initially reporting, and I spent some time with Mike Rinder, basically the number two and number three in the current Church of Scientology, left. And they have formed what they call the independent Scientology movement. They're still Scientologists. They believe very strongly in L. Ron Hubbard's teachings. They practice everything to the letter, but they're not part of the organization of Scientology any longer because they have very strong opposition to the leadership. And they have appealed through the internet, through various websites, to a lot of other people who either left around the same time they did, or maybe even left 10 or 15 years ago, and put their beliefs aside because they didn't really have an outlet to practice them. And these guys are saying, well, you can come and practice them with us. We'll give you auditing. We'll create a community for you online. And this has happened. And it's, I think, becoming extremely threatening to Scientology, because what they're saying is, we're not going to use any of the punitive tactics that the Church of Scientology uses on its members, which is a form of control. And we're not going to charge you an exorbitant amount of money, so it will be affordable for you. And these are the two issues, the affordability and the control, that I think have really hurt Scientology over the years.
Thanks so much, Janet.
Thank you so much.
That's Janet Reitman, whose new book, Inside Scientology, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So Borders, the bookstore, the book chain, we've been following this story for a long time. You certainly have been. Is it finally over?
It is. This week, Borders announced that they could not find a buyer and that they would begin to liquidate their remaining 399 stores beginning this week. This was no big surprise to people in the publishing industry who have watched this very slow process over the last few months. As we know, in February, Borders declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and said that it had hoped to emerge from bankruptcy by the end of the summer. Obviously, that's not going to happen.
Julie, what happens to all the books? Aren't there, there are hundreds of stores, books on the shelves. What happens to them?
Well, when Borders declared Chapter 11 in February, they closed down, after they did that, they closed down about one-third of their then 650 stores. And those stores were liquidated. They had these, you know, huge fire sales and sold a lot of their books at a very good discount. The books in the remaining stores will now be considered the property of the liquidators, and they won't be returned to the publishers, but instead they will be considered what is left of Borders. And there will also be very big sales at the remaining 400 stores.
Julie, we're here in New York City, which, how to say this, has kind of been a Barnes & Noble town. There are lots of Barnes & Noble bookstores, so there are some Borders as well. But if you go to the Midwest, where you're from and where I live for much of my life, Borders has been hugely important to books and culture there. Is that right? Big cities like Chicago or Detroit or Madison, Wisconsin. This is a major, major change for them.
Absolutely. And this is what, you know, publishers have said, that, you know, Borders did have sort of a Midwestern sensibility. They started in 1971 as with a single used bookstore in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And there were, you know, tons of Borders bookstores in Michigan. In Chicago alone, I think there was something like 12 or 14 Borders at one point. And even in the last 5 years, they were still building Borders stores, even when the stores that were in Chicago were still largely unprofitable stores. I talked to an owner of the store Women and Children First, which is a feminist and children's bookstore in the Andersonville neighborhood in Chicago. And she said that she's been totally bewildered for the last 5 or 10 years, because all around her, there were tons of Borders stores opening up. And she was just wondering, why did they keep doing this? Now, of course, there are still a few really good independent stores left in Chicago, but not nearly as many as when those Borders stores started expanding.
Julie, it's inevitable that the question arises, is Borders the victim of what's really been a revolution in book publishing, or is this a case of bad management, bad business decisions, or both?
I think that if you ask people in the industry, they would say that it was mostly bad management, a series of really bad decisions, and a company that really started to go astray when it was sold to Kmart a very long time ago, in the early 90s. Naturally, Borders was in many ways a victim of market forces. You know, when you talk to retail analysts, they say that the United States in general has too many retail stores, that the publishing industry and the bookstore market is changing so quickly that there just isn't going to be a market for two enormous national book chains. You know, we saw this with the electronics industry several years ago when Circuit City declared bankruptcy. There just wasn't enough of a market for two large national electronics chains. But, you know, everyone has seen this coming. Everyone has seen, as Borders has cycled through CEOs and top management. And, you know, unlike the Riggio family that's been running the Barnes & Noble stores for a very long time, borders tended to bring in people who didn't really know much about the book business.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Adam Ross is one of America's most exciting and accomplished new fiction writers. His novel, Mr. Peanut, was reviewed on the cover of the New York Times Book Review by none other than Scott Turow, who called it an enormous success, brilliant, powerful, and memorable. Adam Ross has a new collection of short stories. It's called Ladies and Gentlemen. It's reviewed for us this week by Dean Bacopoulos, who compares Adam Ross, Lucky Guy, to Chekhov, Raymond Carver, Alice Munro, and others, and says his embedded narratives feel organic rather than orchestrated. I'm delighted that Adam's here to talk about his new book. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you have a huge hit, very ambitious, intricate, much admired, praised novel. Now you do short stories. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, in fact, the short stories that comprise Ladies and Gentlemen were written during enforced breaks from Mr. Peanut. Mr. Peanut's complexity occasionally arrested me. And being a disciplined guy, I would, during these periods when I didn't know which fork to take or how to link these disparate narratives, I would follow inspiration on a much smaller scale. That led to, by the time Mr. Peanut was near completion, a manuscript of some 13 stories, which we subsequently winnowed down to 7. So really, not only is Ladies and Gentlemen a companion book to Mr. Peanut, but it brilliantly gets me around the sophomore slump.
Fiction, we understand, even at this late date, and particularly in the case of a gifted writer like yourself who draws on your own experience mm-hmm. to tell stories, it seems to work best. The kind of fiction you do, Alice Munro, Chekhovian fiction, is really about ordinary lives, how they're illuminated. Give us an example of how you draw on your experience or your upbringing or background to invent a short narrative.
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. The second story in the collection is called The Rest of It, and it's about a lonely professor who, at the outset of the story, is struggling with an unnamed sort of ennui that is keeping him very solitary and hanging back in his office. He befriends the college's maintenance man, who tells him stories that are almost Conradian in their sort of high seas level of adventure and blood and death. These stories actually end up becoming more and more insidious and draw this professor into circumstances which he's not quite capable of dealing with. The first story that this maintenance man, Mike Donato, tells was a story that was told to me in a somewhat different form by my best friend's father when I was 13. And there was one image from the story that had haunted me for so long, I just could never shake it. And so something that lingers with you, and then you fit it into a more kind of aesthetic, intellectual framework. I mean, I am very interested in Ladies and Gentlemen with the responsibility of the listener to the storyteller. Like, what does it mean when you say to someone, tell me your story? What is the moral contract between, you know, speaker and listener? Because it means a great deal to ask someone to give you their view, to share, you know, as it were, what they've seen and what they thought about it. And another experience would be from the story Middleman. It's about a kid who is a child actor whose father is a big voiceover guy who learns at the outset of the story that his name, Rose, is not his real name. His real name is Rosenberg, and it leads to a very relentless pursuit of identity. The kid goes to the Trinity School.
You're in Manhattan.
Yes, as I did. He was a child actor, as I was. But needless to say, in spite of the numerous precocious and brilliant kids I was surrounded by at Trinity back in the day, you are not looking at a kid who wrestled with his Judaism or lack thereof. So, but it was interesting looking back, realizing in some ways what a gaping hole in my life it was not having a religion. Because, you know, my father, who was a cantor in synagogue, was in flight from his Judaism. for reasons both personal and philosophical. My mother, who was an Episcopalian, had the same sort of ambivalent relationship to religion. And so they were ethical culturites, you know, and they had that assumption, which is so funny to me now, in this time of helicopter parents and overdetermined kids, that he'll just find his way to something, which is just very much a sort of operating assumption for a lot of kids of my generation. And so I took some of those autobiographical experiences, which I think are very interesting about, you know, what it means to be a child actor and playing roles, and then, you know, married it, hybridized it with some real questions I've been asking for a long time about what it means to be raised without being bound back, which is, you know, the etymological meaning of religion. You know, I wasn't bound back to a tradition.
Adam, you were a child actor. Tell us about that.
I fell into it, even though my father was a Broadway musical actor and a voiceover guy. My brother and I actually, our careers were launched when we auditioned for an after-school special at our public school. We went to PS 59 on 57th between 2nd and 3rd. And it was a Randall Kleiser directed short film with Melvin Douglas and Barbara Rush. My non-speaking role turned into a speaking role. And then next thing you know, I landed the part as Alan Alda's son in The Seduction of Joe Tynan with Meryl Streep and Barbara Harris and Rip Torn and Melvin Douglas. Suddenly I was a working boy, spending a lot of time around adults and doing cool stuff, like doing a dead form, like The Eternal Light, full hour-long radio dramas, or E.G. Marshall's Mystery Theater, things I listened to all the time as a kid, but which now you can't, you know, the closest you get, I guess, is something like Garrison Keillor, but which, you know, again, don't really exist.
Did that experience as an actor at all inform you as a writer? I notice when you talk about your fiction, you talk about the speaker and the listener, almost mm-hmm. as if it's an oral form.
I mean, looking back, absolutely, on so many different levels. First of all, actors, generally speaking, are great raconteurs. Actors want attention, generally speaking, and the best way to get attention is to tell a good story. You would be around pros who knew how to grab you by the shirt collar. But then also, for instance, when you did things like Eternal Light or even television, I did a TV show for NBC called Hot Hero Sandwich, and you saw, you know, we were working with writers who were writing at the same time, who were moonlighting on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. You know, you would see the process of editing something down to what really plays.
And did that begin at the script stage?
It began at the script stage, and then it goes to the rehearsal stage, and then it goes to the taping stage, and then it goes to the editing stage. I mean, so it doesn't surprise me, for instance, later when I was a newspaper editor and staff writer in Nashville, I became really comfortable, for instance, with the editing process, because I am a big believer in the move from alpha to omega, from the idea to the finished thing, and how it only gets a little bit better.
Thanks a lot, Adam.
Thank you.
That's Adam Ross, whose short story collection, Ladies and Gentlemen, is reviewed in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, good news. There are some new books on the list this week. Starting over on the fiction side, as expected, George R.R. Martin lands on top with A Dance with Dragons, the latest in his mega-selling Song of Ice and Fire series. Jennifer Weiner, another perennial bestseller, is back at number 3. Her novel is called Then Came You, and it is a story of a group of women bound in the sort of odd relationships of surrogate motherhood and egg donorship. And we even have one new book by a brand new author. I've been talking a lot lately about how tough it is for new writers to break onto the list. Down at number 7, there is a new neurothriller called Before I Go to Sleep. It is by S.J. Watson, who is kind of a bit of a Cinderella story. 3 years ago, he was a sort of 30-something audiologist working in London for the National Health Service, helping deaf children. He was kind of an aspiring novelist, had never managed to publish anything, but he won a spot in the Faber Academy, which is kind of a very commercially minded mini MFA program run by the very august publisher Faber and Faber. And by the end of the course, he had a manuscript in hand. Soon he had a 37-country deal, a film deal with Ridley Scott, and now he's got a bestseller.
Wow, great story. What about nonfiction?
New book on top, J.C. Dugard lands in the top spot with her memoir, A Stolen Life. She, of course, is the woman who was held in captivity for 18 years and forced to bear children by the man who kidnapped her. She knocks Laura Hillenbrand down to number two. Hillenbrand's Unbroken has been on the list for 35 weeks. I would not be surprised if she climbs back on top again before she's gone. And the conservative firebrand Laura Ingraham lands at number five with her latest. It's called A V. I Zing. And lest that seems a little too irreverent, down at number 14, John Julius Norwich scores a bestseller with his History of the Papacy, Absolute Monarchs, reviewed on our cover a few weeks ago by Bill Keller.
Speaking of religion, Janet Reitman, who was our guest on the podcast this week talking about Scientology, had some interesting things to say about L. Ron Hubbard. Now, he had some kind of relationship with the bestseller list. Is that true?
He had many bestsellers, starting with his first book, Dianetics, which was published in 1950. Nobody knew who he was. He was very obscure. He had not yet founded the religion of Scientology. This was sort of more of a kind of self-help mind cure type book. And despite having basically no advertising, very few reviews, most of them negative, he got this book on the bestseller list, and it spent 28 weeks there. Eventually, it did get reviewed a lot of places, including in the Book Review, which it was very interesting to look up the review and see that, you know, we had a psychologist writing the book about the book quite respectfully, but ultimately quite negatively. And then, of course, Dianetics became the foundation for Scientology and all that follows from that. And interestingly, I was sort of looking into Hubbard's sales history, and in the 80s, he died in 1986. There was a revised edition of Dianetics, which did really well, but he had more than a dozen bestsellers within a few years, including, you know, at one point, Dianetics was number one on the nonfiction list. He had four or five of his science fiction novels on the paperback list. He was sort of like George R. R. Martin in that way. By this point, Scientology was a very well-oiled machine, and there were all sorts of accusations that they were, in fact, manipulating the bestseller list. I found a story that the LA Times did in 1990 where they quoted some former employees of Bridge Publications, which is a publishing house founded and controlled by Scientologists that publishes all of Hubbard's books. And some former employees said that the publisher had sent Scientologists into stores to buy hundreds of books at a pop, paying cash, so these sales could not be traced. Another former employee claimed that Scientology had a list of the bookstores, which are tracked by the New York Times bestseller list, which is a secret list. You know, I don't know who those stores are. You don't know who those stores are. The Bridge people denied this, and the New York Times also said they had not found any pattern of manipulation, but there was kind of this question as to whether these books were really appealing to a sort of broad readership or to loyal Scientologists who really wanted to keep Hubbard on the bestseller list just to sort of have that imprimatur.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.